Are you ready to rewind? Take a nostalgia-filled ride back to a simpler time. It's Acid Wash Memories, a retro pop culture celebration. And now your hosts, Joe Marotta and Michael Quinn.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 69 of Acid Wash Memories, a retro pop culture celebration. Today we are talking about the internet, a series of tubes. My name is Joe Marotta, alongside Michael Quinn. How you doing there, Michael?
Howdy ho.
Howdy ho.
69!
Yeah, we have arrived here, the vaunted 69
episodes. The only time.
Thank you guys for stumbling upon us here or rejoining us if you're here for the first time. We are a retro pop culture celebration. Each week is a different slice of retro pop culture. Today we're talking about the internet, but we've got all kinds of episodes, 68 of them, available where, Mr. Quinn?
In the archives.
In the archives. You'll find something you like. And whether you're a first-timer or a long-timer, we would love it if you followed us on Twitter at AWM Podcast. And we have a Facebook group. Yes, we have Facebook. Remember that?
Yeah, Facebook.
It's on the internet.
It is.
See? It's all connected.
It's all connected by tubes.
Yes, a series of them, actually.
A series of them.
And you can join our tubular...
Shut up!
Sorry. Facebook group. Just go to Acid Wash Memories, hit the join group button, and we will let you in. Well, that's it for the particulars. The internet, Quinn, we're talking about it.
It's here.
It's ubiquitous.
It has come. The internet has arrived.
Yes, it's finally here. We finally have an internet.
No ARPANET, no more.
No.
It's for everyone.
No Usenet only,
yeah,
you know.
All F that.
F that.
It's like we can be on the internet.
And again, the internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes.
What does it all mean?
How did we get here?
And that's how everyone was when it first came about. Everyone
literally.
Like, what the hell? What's an internet?
It's a series of tubes.
Oh, golly. Yeah, that's real funny. Making fun of an old man trying to explain the internet, huh? Well, I've got a tube for you, and I'll show you where you can stick it.
Yeah, what is it, Brian Gumble? What is internet anyway?
Yeah.
Wasn't that what he said?
What is internet anyway?
I've also heard the term, what is an internet?
What is an internet?
Nobody knew what to call it. Is it a thing? What is internet?
Nobody knew, but people wanted to know, because the internet, as it gained prominence in the 1990s, quickly, like meteorically, turned into this thing that some people had, to most people had, to now everybody.
You have to have. It's like, it was like the telephone by the end of it.
It's almost become a utility, would you say?
I would say it. By now, it is. It just is.
In practice, it is, right?
Yeah,
I think you'd have to call it one.
But it didn't seem like one, and I think that's what's funny, right? Because we grew up during it, right? A lot of us did. Now,
mm-hmm.
probably your kids always had it, so it's like,
oh, yeah.
They don't know. We saw like a utility come about in our lifetimes, which is weird because the only people that could really say that were probably people who lived in the early 1900s
when
the telephone came about, or the people that existed when running water came about,
or electricity perhaps.
Yeah,
I mean, it's interesting. Our generation, we're millennials. We apologize for that, but that's just when we were born, was the mid 80s. Our generation, and maybe into the beginning of the Gen Z generation, are kind of the last ones that grew up perhaps without it being commonplace.
It just wasn't in my home until the late 90s.
Yeah, same here.
It's like I knew of it in the mid 90s.
Right.
That's when I first knew of it. But it wasn't something like you thought like, oh, you have to know what you're doing to have internet. People just didn't understand.
Or you had to have a lot of money maybe and be from Connecticut.
You know,
like Jonathan Facento, things like that.
Having the internet in our home has had a great impact on our lives. Rich keeps up with the stock market and our investments, and I'm able to pay the bills in half the time it used to take me.
You know, nowadays, you got this podcast from the internet. I don't think you went to your local library and checked it out, right?
Yeah,
you got it on the internet.
And it's easy to hook up now. It used to be a whole thing.
Used to be a whole procedure. We'll be talking about all of that. Now, I do want to somewhat disclaim this. There are a lot of technical details that go into making an internet, right?
Right.
We cannot possibly cover them all for two reasons. A, we don't have enough time. Two, I don't understand it.
Right.
So
just know that this is more about the social kind of like pop culture impacts of it, because that was really like how it hit the mainstream, right? Was that there was applications that people could actually use that were not very technical or anything.
Right, where it starts affecting people's everyday lives.
Right.
You have a whole new situation.
As a parent, I've never been happier than when my children ask their friends over for an internet computer party.
But because this is Asawash Memories, and sometimes we're a light history podcast, as you termed it once, Quinn, right?
Light history. When we want to use it.
Only when we feel like it. We'll start in the 1950s. Well, I guess I should mention first, the telegraph is technically an ancestor of the internet in the
absolutely
right,
because yeah.
it allowed,
it's the first telecommunications there is,
yeah, transmission between two different locations, right. But in the 1950s, the mainframe computer had come about, and what do we really know about these? They're large, right?
Yes, very large.
In a whole room.
And I mean, all computers had existed in a whole room even before the 50s,
before the mainframe,
any kind of computer, period.
And what types of things are they doing, Quinn? Are these very advanced things, or are they very basic things?
It depended. I mean, like, they used them for mostly math calculations that it would take a human to do a very long time. That was, like, the first main application, right? Was that, like, counting of some kind.
Hence the term computing, I guess.
Yeah.
Computed things, right?
Yeah.
Seriously.
The hero of our story tonight is the giant electronic brain developed by Remington Rand, UNIVAC. Now, recent experiments show that future use of UNIVAC may give us faster and more accurate weather predictions than were ever possible before.
The modem also came about around the same time, because obviously, you know, the plain old telephone system, that had existed by the 50s. So modems were already being experimented with, you know, using a telephone line to connect one computer to something else.
The telegraph is the perfect way to understand why computers were so compatible with the concept, right? Because what a telegraph essentially does is it sends an electric signal on, an electric signal off. And that's how what Morse code is. It's just a series of on off, you know, taking breaks, and they made a code out of it, right?
Yep.
It's like you listen, it's like, okay, I hear three clicks here, like a break, another two clicks, and then I know what that means, right? A computer does exactly the same thing. It sends zeros and ones.
Yeah, binary.
So it's the they're very compatible with each other.
That's a great point. Obviously, the main difference being in Morse code, you have a human interpreter that has to know the code, whereas in computing, you have another computer that understands.
Talking to another computer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The Sage computer speeds the information for decisions by man in our missile age.
Now, in the 1950s, a guy by the name of J.C.R. Licklider, it is episode 69, his nickname was Lick, and I'm not making that up.
J.C.R. Licklider, known to all as Lick, saw their growing potential.
The computer technology has been moving in a way that nothing else people have ever known has moved.
This is actually a computer scientist who, among many other things, he developed something known as the time-sharing system for computing, which was unveiled in 1962. Time-sharing, Quinn, I guess in basic terms, is using one computer resource across multiple users or across multiple applications, right?
Because back in the old days, before we had super fast processors, the actual computer would take a while to actually figure out operations.
Right.
So you'd run an application through it, and it might take hours for it to process the request. And so the idea was, well, what if we can share, you know, rent out, get one big fast computer, and then people can share it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Much like me, when I eat Taco Bell, it takes me a few hours to process it.
Right,
you know?
Yeah,
but
exactly.
We all do. We all do.
Taco Bell's meat is, their meat is a series of tubes.
So Lick's idea here, in his own words, was
a network of such centers connected to one another by wideband communication lines, the functions of present-day libraries, together with anticipated advances in information storage and retrieval and symbiotic functions.
This all sounds very lovely.
Very lovely. Essentially, he's talking about computers talking to each other and all accessing the same thing, right? So in the 60s, we had packet switching, which we have talked about in the past, believe it or not.
But I mean, that's like the one of the core functions of, like, how the internet technically works. It sends packets of data. And
can you bare bones explain that for the folks?
It's just, it sends packets of data in little clumps rather than like all of it at once.
Which is faster, yeah. Exactly. There was the NPL network developed in the 60s using this packet switching, and the Merit network, but most famously, the ARPANET.
Yes.
A simple way to interconnect computers and to form such a network is to place wideband leased circuits, in the case of the ARPANET, 50 kilobit per second circuits, between each of the computers, and then to interconnect each of the computers to each other to form a fully connected network.
So the ARPANET was the government involved in this. This is where the whole Al Gore
Right.
Meme came from of right. like he never said he invented the internet.
He probably just was one of the people that signed the bill to pass the funding or something, right?
Yes, that's exactly what it was.
All those people made the internet, not just anybody who signed said, "Hey, you can buy this, or, like make it or whatever," right?
Even Strom Thurmond?
I'm guessing whoever was in the Senate or Congress or whatever, they're all technically the fathers or mothers of the internet.
Do
right?
you mean to tell me the ultimate irony is Joe Lieberman could have been a father of the internet?
It's possible. Yeah.
Our good friend of the show.
It really just depends on who was in the Congress that passed that bill.
Al Gore was one of them. Yeah. That we know.
During my service in the United States Congress, I took the initiative in creating the internet.
As with a lot of things, the highway system, Quinn, being one, national defense is a primary driver in these big leaps that the government decides to make.
In the United States. Most countries don't spend the amount of money that we do.
No, but we spend, baby.
Yeah.
And if you're listening on the other side of the pond, you have the internet too, so you can follow along with this, right?
But essentially the idea was it's just another means of communication for the military or whatever, right? They could send messages to each other over the phone lines or whatever.
Yeah, from computers.
Like, instead of calling.
Now, remember, crash course here. This is before PCs, right? These computers are operated by like highly trained individuals that understand what they're doing.
I wouldn't say the ARPANET was before PCs. PCs existed in the 70s, but...
Yeah, but the ARPANET was the late 60s. It's kind of the time frame you're talking about. Yeah. But you're right. It's before PCs were commonplace anyway, you know, with IBM and all that in the later 70s. In the 70s, we saw the rise of the Cyclades network. Yes, of course. Everyone knows that one.
We always talk about the Cyclades network.
Big fan of Cyclades.
I had the Cyclades... No.
You did?
Nobody did.
My favorite X-Men character. There was Usenet. Good friends at Usenet.
Now, Usenet, I mean, that was pretty big even in the 90s still as far as a way to communicate.
I think there's still people sitting around chatting on that now. To this day.
Usenet never went away,
it
really.
It never really went away.
Hi. Yeah, I used to like Usenet.
Now, Usenet is a way to talk to people on the internet. Right. Electronic bulletin boards or whatever they used to call.
There's all different means, right? I mean, you had your forums, bulletin boards, and email would eventually come about, like direct communication.
Direct communication.
Yeah.
Another thing that came about in the 70s was TCP/IP protocol. Without getting in a whole big thing, it's still the way like internet was like used forever.
Yeah, it's basically like, think about it on your router.
Yep.
It's how everything can have its own address, and you can have multiple computers on one internal network, and then they can connect out. That's basically what it is.
Yep, just a protocol. The first usage, here's some trivia, of the word internet appeared in December of 1974. Internet was meant as a short form of internetworking.
Right.
That's all it is.
The internet, the big difference between the internet was like that a lot of people, I think, don't fully understand is before the internet, there was a bunch of smaller networks across the country.
Like
Cyclades. Like ARPANET's an example, but that was just one. The reason ARPANET was the big one is because it was the government-funded one that connected all over the country, whereas there was smaller networks that, you know, like Berkeley or MIT or whatever, yep. Where it was just a bunch of computers in that area. And the idea was the internet was like, what if all of those networks were connected to each other.
Exactly.
Right? And the ARPANET was the bones of it, right? Because all the little networks, because the ARPANET went everywhere in the country, they could connect into the ARPANET, and then everything's connected.
And then you have an internetwork.
Right, exactly. Hence internet. So the concept of the internet was like the idea of like, what if there was one to rule them all, right? It was one big network
exactly
that everyone
right.
could participate in.
Well said, Quinn. It's very similar. You know, we talked about the history of cell phones and cellular technology. Very similar to the 70s and 80s car phone days where there's all these small little ones, and then eventually everything kind of just got...
They all connected to each other.
Exactly.
Yeah. But the reason the ARPANET's always brought up is because it's like the bones, right? It was like the network that was all over the country.
Right, and it was the government one.
Right.
The NFS net succeeded the ARPANET in the late 70s. Mm-hmm. And by the 1980s, we had CSNET in 1981. The UK had NREN, N-R-E-N. Yeah, the UK got involved in this with their own little network.
Well, everyone started doing it once they figured it out, right? It was like, okay, this is definitely a way of communicating.
Yeah, exactly. But there was no true standard yet by the late 1980s even, because something that was going on, you know, you've heard of the Burger Wars, you've heard of the Cola Wars, you've heard of the Format Wars. There was the protocol wars,
right?
And without getting into all the details here, ultimately, like we said, TCP IP won.
But it was still difficult to even connect to other users, right? Because there was no, there was no overarching, like, what do you type in? Like, right? It was like you, the TCP, it was like, well, you could connect to an address, but that's not really shorthand or anything like that. Like, you know, that's, it's like copying down a phone number, right?
Essentially.
It's like, this is a little silly. And there had to be some better way to do that, right?
There had to be. And by the late 1980s, the first ISPs, internet service providers, were formed.
Right.
There was PSINet, not a famous one. There was UUNet, two U's, and there was NetCom. And by 1989, the first commercially available email service, believe it or not, MCI Mail.
There you go.
It's called MCI Mail. Instead of using a mailbox, you send mail electronically.
One of the other problems, right, is you needed a connecting, like a doorway into the internet, right? You couldn't just hook your computer up to like any old phone line and just like, I'm in now, like, and just type something to it, right?
Hello world,
like,
maybe.
You needed, the ISPs were like doorways into the actual network,
yeah,
right? So you would connect to that doorway. There was all sorts of them all over the country, but essentially the service they were providing was, it's like, okay, you're now like in the internet. You connect to us, and we connect you to the general internet.
There you go, the general internet.
Yeah.
The first dial-up service, actually, which was 1989, was the world, rather fittingly.
The world at your fingertips.
Let's be clear, by 1989, by the turn of the decade, none of this was by any means widespread.
No, but you're noticing a tightening of each thing coming along, that like one thing led to the next, that led to the next, that led to the next, and it's all happening within months.
Very quickly.
It's very, like, every couple months there's something new.
ISPs are popping up, email clients are popping up. You know, CompuServe came about.
Yeah,
and we
all because
about
this general concept is there, that now there's all these needs for all these little aspects of it to function. Right.
And obviously, from a, you know, capitalistic point of view, if companies see that there's a way to profit off of the everyday consumer, they are going to design things in a way where they can sell it.
But interesting enough, even in the late 80s, when all of this stuff was happening, it still was in this bubble of really only professors in colleges and really people who could see the future, who truly understood what the potential of this was. That was really all that could be understood, even at this point when all this stuff was popping up, right?
I'd say that's about right. I think most people either didn't know or were indifferent to all of this.
It really took, it really was limited to people with great minds that understood how powerful this was, and entrepreneurs, very few of them, by the way, like they were considered crazy for investing into this. This is how like silly the concept was, because people couldn't see the, what was the application, right? Like, what was,
what
the,
do you use it
like
for?
This is really cool that computers can talk with each other, but what the fuck is the point?
Yeah, it might have been viewed more of a novelty,
right?
Because you got to remember, by the end of the 80s here, we've had, you know, this is Ronald Reagan's America, folks, and a lot of people are very happy.
You have to understand that the concept of e-commerce didn't even exist. And that's where the money is, right?
That's a great way to say
Nobody understood that. They didn't get that they could sell things on it, but it could. And the great minds understood that. They understood that you can do anything on it.
You know, one of the great minds involved in all of this was a gentleman by the name of Tim Berners-Lee.
Yes.
In 1989.
And this is the breakthrough.
This is the big breakthrough. He had been working on something that he called the World Wide Web.
Right.
Which, let's break for a second here to mention that the World Wide Web and the internet are not synonymous.
Yeah, but it's kind of like Hershey's and chocolate, right? It's like that kind of thing.
Although the net and the web are pretty much married to each other, they're fundamentally different.
The idea here is, remember we were saying before how it was like, it's not really easy to connect to this, or like find anything for that matter, right? This guy comes up with this idea that, you know, there's two things, right? It's the way the addresses are, so www dot,
the HTTP protocol,
HTTP and HTML is part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that essentially you could not only have a way to type in where what you want to go and find, right? So the address,
yep,
and in a legible format, not numbers
like Unix or something,
and B, that the universal way they talk and display with each other through HTML. So what HTML was, it was a very simple but effective way to make a web page, hyperlinks. That was like a feature
of
the World Wide Web, right?
That was actually a big deal.
Right. It was like, oh, if you click on this, it will connect you to this. But it's all through plain text. You just, you know, when you're writing it, you just put, what is the World Wide Web address?
Yep.
And then you connect it. And like, we're talking in very basic terms, but that's how it works.
And that's something that is like, and understandably so, is very much taken for granted in the 21st century.
Right.
Rightfully so. I mean, it's just become part of life, right?
Right.
But the idea that you could easily type in, you know, like cookie.com, right?
Right.
Is that a website?
Cookie.com. Back then, because remember, you had to do the www. Some of them you had to make http://www. Like, you had to, like, this was before the browsers, because the browsers come about because of this.
This is a good point.
Right.
But the idea that you could go to cookie.com, right? And then you can click on chocolate cookie and it'll pop up something that you could read about.
Just click on it, and the next thing you know, we'll be surfing the net.
And let's also remember, around the turn of the decade, there's no Windows 95 yet.
Yeah.
Like, they're still running.
There's 3.1. But the big thing that's very interesting about World Wide Web when it first came out, this is, I don't know if you know this little factoid.
Ooh, I like learning.
But when Berners-Lee made it, and he made the demo browser, the browser that, you know, how it worked or whatever, and even the server for all this stuff, guess what computers it was on?
Apple II? What was
even worse, Next. Steve Jobs.
Oh,
joint.
The one after he left.
But it was
Apple.
A really expensive computer.
Right.
It was like $4,000 even back then.
Right,
like,
right.
But Berners-Lee did it all on there, because I don't know if that was just the demo or whatever. Like, you know, because the Next units were great at like everything back then. They were good at networking. And like, they were like, a lot of people thought that the Next units were like the future. Like, that was going to be where the PCs were going to go.
It was in their name. Next.
Right, yeah.
But it wasn't Next, it was Last.
Stop.
The point is around this time, computers started appearing in the home. Around the late 80s, right? More and more.
It is a perfect storm if you think about it, right? Because on top of it, while all this is going on, these advances in the internet, the PC itself is becoming more affordable, right?
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
So if something is more affordable, more people are naturally going to buy it. And there's also kind of like the keeping up with the Joneses philosophy.
Yeah.
It's like, well, they have a computer, I got to get one, and it snowballs. Right.
And that's not to say even in the 80s and the early 90s, we're talking pre-internet, people were buying these things anyway. I remember one application that was very popular, like QuickBooks. People wanted to do their taxes, right?
Or Quicken
or whatever.
Lotus or one of them.
Doing your taxes was like a big application on these things. And you didn't need to connect it. It would print out the forms and like it would do all the math for you. And like it was great. It was a great thing. You didn't have to go to an accountant anymore, right?
I was afraid of the computer. But with Quicken, it's easy to use.
And hand in hand with this is that, you know, the typewriter was still very popular. And if any people that had learned to, like parents, you know what I mean, had already learned to type, transferring that to a computer was not that big of a
step. Well, because the keyboard was exactly the same as a typewriter. So, you know, that was another idea, was I can write letters, print them out, and they're perfect. And spell check had come along.
Yeah.
And like, everything's great. And I can print it out and I can put it in the mail and send it, right?
Because
again, you have no internet, remember. So like, everything was, you still need, a printer was still a big thing to also have with this, right?
It was
like useless. The fucking computer was useless without a printer.
And they were usually around that time, what, dot matrix printers or daisy wheel?
In the early 90s, we already had a laser because we has a hand-me-down, but like,
you're fancy, Quinn.
Yeah, that was just a hand-me-down.
I didn't have no laser. I had an inkjet was my
first
printer.
I'll tell you what, printer. The laser was unbelievable. It was even later on. When I had my own printer and it was an inkjet, I was like, this fucking blows compared to the laser. The laser was amazing.
I am still impressed by a laser printer.
It's unbelievable. It's just perfect. Like, it never Fs up. The ink is last seemingly forever.
Yeah, that toner continues, man.
Yeah, it was like literally the best investment you could make during
the printer era. It's true, because even modern inkjet is like, why is it crooked?
It's always horrible. Like, I remember that laser, and it was like, that thing, It operated no matter what. Like, it didn't give a shit. It was just like, I'm going to print this perfectly and evenly, and I loved it.
You need a Canon laser printer to make the printed page look better for as little as $2,800.
So the World Wide Web opened officially to the public in January of 1991, and the first website ever was CERN, C-E-R-N, in Switzerland, in August of 1991.
And CERN was part of the organization that got www off the ground.
Correct.
Right? So yes. that obviously they're going to have the first website.
They
right?
have the first website. Info.cern.ch, which is the country right. code for Switzerland. If you want to check it out, I think it still exists.
Did they have the code for the initial browser or something on it? Like, I remember that was like part of it because it was all open.
I don't know. The initial browser was what, Mosaic, I believe, if I'm
no,
not
mistaken. No. There was like a made by them.
Yeah,
Tim Berners-Lee's like, that's the browser, but the source code was available. That's why all these other ones came up.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think Mosaic was the first popular one.
Right.
Anyway. But now we're into the 90s, and in the 90s, a lot of things happened with the internet. We're going to be talking about them as well as its impact on society, on culture, and even on our everyday lives here in the 21st century. We'll be doing all of that as soon as we visit the Cyclades Network.
Yes.
When more Acid Wash Memories returns.
Did you get a computer recently? Well, congratulations. You can now join hundreds of thousands who've discovered Prodigy, a service that has hundreds of practical uses, hundreds of things to enjoy. Connect Prodigy to your computer and get stock quotes almost as fast as a broker. Play educational games. Get sports scores faster than on TV. Shop at home. Discover all you can do for just $9.95 a month on Prodigy. Finally, what the PC was invented for. See it at a dealer near you.
Hi, Ken Kemsky for Diamondback's Computer Warehouse. Friends, don't pay those high mail order prices. Look at this 386SX, 44 meg Seagate hard drive, 1 meg of RAM, beautiful VGA color monitor. Full 1-year warranty, only $15.99. Or how about this 28612 VGA starter system, only $7.99. Friends, only at Diamondback's Computer Warehouse.
When you want a hamburger on Monday, who wants to wait till Thursday to eat it? That's crazy. That's not the way we do it at Wendy's. We have 7 delicious items on our Super Value menu, just 99 cents each. Baked potatoes with sour cream, garden salads, chili, and even junior bacon cheeseburgers. Every day, 99 cents. And you can count on it. There's another one. I guess they don't think I get hungry every day.
The Super Value menu, 7 items for 99 cents each, 7 days a week, only at Wendy's.
Tubes. Hey, welcome back. Thanks for logging in to Acid Wash Memories episode number 69. Joe Morata and Tim Berners-Lee, I mean Michael Quinn here.
That's me.
Hope you like the Cyclades Network, folks, and
yes.
CERN and all
Cyclades.
That stuff. Listen, we like to sprinkle in some of this technical stuff and this history because, quite frankly, we enjoy it and so do other people.
Yeah, but now we're hitting the point of the mainstream. Like, here's the stuff you probably heard of.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, honestly. Which, by the way, on the internet, please follow us on Twitter.
Yeah,
join our Facebook group on the internet. And also leave us a review of this podcast if you'd like. That'd be much appreciated. Where we left off was Tim Berners-Lee has opened the internet to the public 1991. So we are talking
the demo browser, the HTML, like all the bare bones. Here it is.
Yep.
Now make shit. Yeah.
And by the early 90s, websites started to become more and more commonplace because if anyone's ever learned HTML, basic HTML, especially in this like web 1.0 or whatever, is very easy to learn.
And that's by design.
Correct.
Like, Berners-Lee didn't want a complicated language or anything.
No.
He wanted, I've heard it described that the idea behind it was that a grade schooler could understand how to use this, right? It was intentionally dumbed down and simple because they're thinking of rapid growth. They don't want it to be.
You don't want to gatekeep.
You don't want to need some computer programmer to make a basic website.
Absolutely,
right?
Yes. And I mean, I think I learned HTML when I was 13 or something.
I learned it on my own. Like,
yeah, so did I.
And I just saw some. Oh, this is how. Okay, this is how you make the page red or like is that easy?
BG
like,
color.
Yeah, this is how you make a hyperlink. Like,
yeah.
But that was all by design. That it was thought up that way on purpose.
Absolutely, and even shortly thereafter, there were all these they call them WYSIWYG editors, you know, what you see is what you get, where you could just make it how you want and it's doing the code behind the scenes.
Right.
That was already in the 90s.
Right.
But anyway, the website started to become more and more commonplace, maybe not mentioned on television yet, you know, not too much. 1993 saw NASA have their website, MTV.com.
Yes.
Believe it or not, the original IMDb DB.
There you go.
In 1993.
And so this was what was cool about it to me was it was the Wild West, right? It was like
the World Wide anybody Web,
can,
Wild West.
Yeah, anybody could have a website, but what do you do with it, right? Like, what is it? It's a page, obviously, with information.
Yes.
At its core.
That's,
right?
That's what it was.
Stupid.
Especially
but
in the early 90s.
At its core, it's a page with information with links to other information,
mm-hmm.
right? With links to other World Wide Web. The thing, again, I want to stress a lot is like World Wide Web essentially is the internet's killer app. That's yeah. what it has to be understood about it. It's like a way of making a thing on the internet.
Yeah, it's not the only, like, email is also on the internet, but email and World Wide Web are not related, I mean, until webmail.
It's ultimately an application.
It is.
Right? It's yeah. ultimately an application, but it's the main one. Because of its ease of use and because of its interactivity and, like, easy to understand for humans, right?
Yeah.
Like, how it works, it became kind of the gateway to other applications, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Right? Because you could do download links where you download a file to another application,
correct,
right?
Yeah.
That you're storing somewhere.
And you could also eventually upload as well.
Right, yeah.
Via HTTP, because there was also FTP file transfer protocol,
right.
which is not web. But it doesn't matter.
But the point is you could get something and you could send something.
Correct.
Right? That's it. And it's easily understandable on a page on your screen. And that's what World Wide Web brought to the table.
What about this internet thing? Do you know anything about that?
Sure.
What the hell is that exactly?
Well, it's become a place where people are publishing information.
Right.
So everybody can have their own homepage. Companies are there. The latest information. It's wild what's going on.
And it grew quickly. This is not all the websites founded in 1994, but among them, Apple and Microsoft both launched their websites
right.
in 94. The BBC
yep.
of England fame.
Oi, mate. You know what BBC stands for, yeah? Beer battered cheaps. Come on now. Get your mind out of the gutter, yeah? Fish.
But news was probably like a huge
yeah.
deal. You know, like that's a obvious, you can read it on the screen, right? Like a newspaper.
I think with the weather page on BBC, though, they just have like a static image. It just says rain every day.
Very funny. Mushy peas.
Other websites founded in 1994 would include Britannica, The Simpsons.
Right.
Sex.com, only appropriate for episode 69.
And that was a good get, by the way, as far as an address is concerned, because there's another, that one of the early applications right off the bat. People realize, wait, we can put pictures on it?
You could check porn and stock quotes.
Ooh, even like salacious pictures?
Oh.
Oh.
And we already, in the video one, we talked about how that was something that...
There's always an audience, Quinn.
I mean, if there's any media format, if it can have sex in it, that's something that will live very
hey,
strongly in it.
I wouldn't bet against the fact that some, you know, shifty Morse code operators were sending some dirty messages
oh,
to
I'm
each other.
As stupid as that sounds, I wouldn't even be surprised. It's like,
you know, it's
people
true.
Will find a way to insert sex into any media format, period.
They certainly will. Speaking of which, Ted Kennedy's website was launched in 1994. And of course, most importantly, PizzaNet. Now, that sounds like a joke, but...
This is an important thing, actually. This is very stupid, but it's such an important step.
It is. Now, this is limited to a small geographic location
right.
in California, I believe it was. But it allowed people to order pizza on the internet.
And what is ordering pizza? It's commerce.
Yes, it's commerce.
And what does that do? All of a sudden, alarm bells go off with the money people. Oh, this isn't just some stupid crap. We can make money off this, right?
This isn't some stupid
crap. This isn't just
crap.
Informational nonsense
yeah.
that has no money in it.
Exactly. I mean, because as rudimentary as that would sound, and I'm sure the website looked like shit because it was 1994, the fact that instead of calling, you could order it on your computer,
right?
That's a game changer.
Right. E-commerce is born.
E-commerce is born. I mean, also, you know, you think of, this is skipping ahead of 95, but like eBay came about in 95.
Right. There's also another development during this time, too. The other, obviously, the concept that e-commerce could exist was important.
Mm-hmm.
But how else could you make money off of this? Advertising.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It was the Wild West as far as what do we charge, you know, for ads and, you know, do you have to click it or how does it all work?
Banner ads, pop-up ads, all this stuff,
right? And that would become one of the early problems with the internet, but also one of the early ways that to make money.
That's the thing. I mean, people that have something to sell will pay for an ad in any place that people are going to see, whether it's a billboard, whether it's an outfield stadium, whether it's on a NASCAR driver's suit.
This is a visual medium.
Correct.
Remember, so billboards are very easy.
Right.
Like, it's like the advertising industry realized, hey, we can advertise to anybody using this thing. And even though it's small now, who knows, right?
Exactly.
Just get our ads in there.
Yep.
Ethan Zuckerman created the first pop-up in 1997 and added it to a website. This, he believes, was the original sin of the internet.
Now, Yahoo came about around the same time, and Yahoo was a big deal. It was not the first search engine.
Okay, yeah, so let's touch on the search engines, right?
Yeah.
So one of the problems with this was, it's a good problem, is there was so much so fast. There were so many websites.
Because anyone can make one.
But you think about this. This is a day before the search engine was a thing, really. And in the early days, there wasn't really a search engine, right? There was some of them, but not
there
really.
There were directories, too. There were directories, split things into categories.
But it was very hard to find what you were looking for, right? And if you found it, this was a common thing. This was a very common thing, especially in the early 90s.
Yeah.
People would write on Post-it notes what the address was because there was no other way to remember. Like, they would just write the address, or maybe they open Notepad in Windows and write it down. But it's like, if you forgot the address, it was like losing a phone number. You'd never be able to find it again.
And some of these websites back then, not everything was just like bababa.com. It was like, you know, mybutt.fortunecity.com or
Got their domain from.
Yeah, exactly. Remember that Fortune City and Zoom with an X and all that?
There was a ton of them.
GeoCities and Angel Fire.
But the point is that like the search engine was a necessary thing that people, it was something people wanted. They wanted to be able to just type in, what am I looking for?
Absolutely. Because like nowadays, you can just type an actual question into your web browser without even going to google.com, right. and you'll get an answer.
And you touched on it, but a lot of the early ideas to this was, you know, there'd be sites with, you know, alphabetical listings, and they'd even organize it in hyperlinks. So if you click A on the hyperlink, it takes you to a page that's a list of websites that start with A.
You do that little tag, yeah.
Like, it's like the phone book, basically, right?
Yeah, directory, yeah.
But you really needed, once it got so big that was out of control, because you have to remember the people doing the directories are also manually. So how the hell, what are they doing? There was people hired to just go on the internet and type stuff to, like, find addresses.
Well, yeah, because search engines now, again, another ubiquitous feature, but seriously, to be able to type in, you know, fish or something, and hit search, and you'll get websites that tell you about fish.
Right.
That's a big deal.
But the main technology in there that was necessary was web crawlers.
Yes, correct.
Because, like we just said, a lot of the way these other sites work is a human would go look for all the websites.
Manually, yeah.
Why do we have to do that? We could just have a computer program.
Yeah.
Put it on the internet and have it just type stuff all day internally and find websites.
I think nowadays they would call that scraping, right? But back then it was called web crawling.
They were web crawler applications. That's all they did, is they went and found addresses.
Now, did they call it a crawler, you think, because spiders weave webs and they crawl?
Probably because they were slow as shit, if I had to guess. Like,
okay, I'll give you that.
I don't know who made that name up, but...
That's funny. In the mid-90s, there was the World Wide Web Consortium, because now countries are getting involved in this. Now all kinds of people.
Right.
Web standards began to be set. And around the same time, Quinn, you know, we talked about a lot of the text aspect, sending and receiving. Well, some of the things that they were sending and receiving were compressed formats such as JPEG and MPEG. Those became a very big deal for the mid-90s internet and beyond.
Right. By the time the internet got popular, there had been different speed modems, obviously, like 28K.
28.
Yeah, but 56K was it wasn't some magic number. It was just the one I feel that it was the technology when the internet came into its best years.
Its adolescence, perhaps.
Like,
its prime years.
It's prime.
Of its adolescence.
It's prime forming years, mainstream years, right? So 56K was just happened to be, okay, this is what exists.
It was
right?
like the de facto standard. But I think, wasn't there also something, and correct me if I'm wrong, you or anyone else, isn't that about the fastest you could transmit it over a regular telephone line?
I've heard that, but then the T1 technically was, and DSL were technically over phone lines, so I don't know.
Yeah, I think something was done on the back end to enable that.
The point is not the technology. The point is the compression formats came about because of the limitations on the bandwidth.
It was a solution to the bandwidth problem.
Yeah, because before this, and even with JPEGs, I mean, you would watch them load.
Oh, I remember.
Right? It was that slow. Like, they were pushing it, but the idea was the compression formats would eventually make this so it would be instant, right? Mm-hmm. And the better they got and the faster the internet got.
The other thing, too, the other file, you know, the MP3, which we talked about in our Napster episode, but that was a huge deal because, you know, what are you going to do, download a WAV? You know how big those were for like a song, but how long that would take?
But even before Napster, MP3, MPEG, these were all devised as ways to send incredibly large files fast.
And it worked.
Yeah.
So in terms of the browsers, Netscape actually became the number one browser in 1994. It superseded Mosaic. And then, of course, you know Microsoft. You know that Bill Gates getting in on it with Windows 95. Internet Explorer was the big answer.
And this started to turn into the first big legal thing of the internet's life, I would say. The big legal controversy, right? And this is what led to, a lot of people probably heard this, but maybe they don't realize what the source of it is. The whole Microsoft antitrust situation.
Yeah, this is a big part of it.
So what happened here, the story is this. Netscape, in its day, was the most popular browser, like how Chrome is now, or maybe Firefox, or
I
even
think it's Chrome, right?
Yeah, I think Chrome is ahead. Yeah, Chrome is well ahead, right?
Yeah.
But the point is that Netscape was that.
Oh, yeah. Netscape was a big deal.
It was really advanced. In fact, when it launched, it was anticipated because of the features it had. Like, it was that good.
That's a good point, too. Like, certain browsers didn't do everything, weren't compatible with the way web pages were made and some of the advancements in HTML that would go
on. Netscape was kind of the one. It was so hyped that, like, there was a demo that went around and Microsoft got their hands on it and they started copying it. Like, all this shit, right?
Faster searches, instant messaging, a customized start page. The new Netscape.
But the point is what Microsoft did that was in question is they started preloading Internet Explorer into Windows.
Yep.
And the idea here was that why would you download Netscape if this is just here? Even if Netscape's free, because Netscape was free.
Like, Netscape was free,
but why would you have to use Internet Explorer just to even go download Netscape? So what's that all about, right?
I think, and I again could be wrong, I think this legally is known as tying, but I might be wrong. But Microsoft was accused of tying antitrust a bunch of different things, and this is part of
it. But this was the big one. This is the one that triggered the whole series of events where the government was like, no, you can't do that.
And Bill Gates is a big pain in the ass on the stand.
Who is at this executive staff meeting?
Probably members of the executive staff.
Increasing IE share on Mac will help increase the number of Windows that you license?
Yeah, I went through the chain of logic that explains that to you. I don't know if you misunderstood some part of it.
The ultimate outcome was that Microsoft had to offer you a different option.
Yes.
Like they could not, they were allowed to keep the operating system, but they had to say, okay, you can use this one or that
correct.
One. Like, yeah.
And Netscape, you know, dominated still for a while, kind of neck and neck with Internet Explorer and faded away and without getting all the browsers.
But what's a shame about Netscape is it really could have to this day been the one, but it was screwed over by this. Like, it never recovered. You know what I mean? Like, but it could have been.
It could have been. It was a fine product.
Yeah.
In the 90s, Quim, was the dot-com boom and, you know, the dot-com bubble. This is like after 1995, once AOL has also made the internet a very, very prominent thing in people's homes.
And if you don't, I know we covered AOL a little bit, but to sum it up, AOL made it very simple, which there was still a bit of complexity to getting on.
Yeah, they made it real simple.
They made it super, because they wrapped it all up in one application.
Yeah.
They put the browser, the chat, all the stuff that you would have to get individually, they put it in one application. That was the big idea.
Messaging,
yeah.
To appeal to just regular everyday people.
America Online is the internet. Email is the best.
No more computer mumbo jumbo.
I send instant messages, type in the keyword, boom, you're there.
They were instrumental in more and more people getting on the internet for the first time. A lot of people's ISP is AOL.
Yes, I would say that AOL is definitely like a lot of people's gateway to the internet.
Absolutely.
In general, right? And I got to give a lot of kudos because AOL kind of became a punchline because of
the merger.
Well, not even just that. I just mean to say is that it was so rudimentary that it kind of got this reputation as like baby's first internet or something. Like people were like, "Oh, you're on AOL. What do you not understand technology or something?"
Well, people still scoff at AOL email addresses today in 2024. Right. Let's be honest.
But I say that's the lasting impact of it, right? Is that like,
yeah,
it was so many people's gateway, and I feel like it deserves like a lot of credit for popularizing the internet.
Absolutely.
Like for me too, it made me understand how each piece of it worked. And then by the time I was ready to take off the AOL training wheels, I knew, okay, I want this thing from that AOL does, but a different version. I want that. And I just had all those applications separately, right?
I think that that's completely fair. I mean, Tiger Woods popularized golf for a whole generation.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's something to be said for like one example of a thing, you know, bringing the masses to it.
It was a really good idea.
Yeah.
AOL brings me to another thing I wanted to bring up on this show and tell me, to me, AOL's the point at which that we started to, remember I was saying the Wild West before, but the point at which we started to just see major corporations do like really weird shit to try to like find something in this internet thing.
In terms of what?
For example, I know, you know, we do WWF stuff sometimes on our other show, right?
Oh yeah, I've heard of it.
But one, I always think they're such a great example because they exemplify, and there was other companies doing what they were doing. They weren't alone in this, but just trying stuff. The idea of what if while the show is on, there's a wrestler in the chat room and you can talk to him about his match or something, right? These were the little stupid things that I adore about early internet. These just experimental like ideas.
Well, I mean, to tell you the truth, that idea of like a live chat, essentially,
and interacting with a celebrity of some
instant,
kind.
Right.
Yeah.
That goes on to this day where people might go live on Instagram and people can.
Social media superseded it, but this was the early concept.
It was groundwork.
It was come to our chat room and we have the person that you're interested in, right? And you can ask him anything.
You can ask Bart Gunn anything you want.
Right, exactly.
And he'll be like, I don't know.
It just held a special place in my heart in the early internet that I remember about it, right?
I'm with you.
Was because I was like, this is so cool.
Yeah.
Right? It was like, this is so awesome.
Yep.
And just interacting with people in general, not even, like, there was those special times in the chat room, but then afterwards, people are chatting about other stuff, and you would find out about things, right? I would be online all the time trying to find out new stuff.
And so was I.
As a kid, just new stuff.
Well, that's what a lot of people loved the internet just for the fact that you could find out stuff.
Right.
Right? I still love the internet for that.
Right.
I love Wikipedia.
But in the early days, chat rooms were a big part of it, too.
Oh, yeah.
Or message forums, right?
Because, message boards, yeah.
Because the idea was you could ask a question and a real person could, like, say, like, oh, I know where that is, or I know what that is, I can tell you about it, or whatever, you know, or go to this link. They might give you a link.
Yeah, go to this doctor, whatever the question is. No, you're right, though.
And that was so powerful in the early internet. There was nothing like that.
No, there was no apparatus that had existed prior. You had to go to the library to find things out.
I feel like that's really what made the term information age become a thing, was that you could find out anything.
And the information superhighway,
right,
as well.
Isn't that a
Bill Clinton thing?
The government started co-opting that as a term for like, we're giving people internet access.
Yeah.
We're going to give them access to the information superhighway.
That's a Bill Clinton initiative.
That's such a political.
Oh,
like,
it's extremely.
When I became president, there were just 50 websites on the World Wide Web. Now there are 17 million.
I think in retrospect, calling it the information age is more applicable.
I think it's appropriate too.
Yeah,
because, less hokey.
Because it was, in a weird way, it was a weird like enlightenment. Would you say like a weird like suddenly the just having the idea that you could, if you had a question, you could get an answer was a huge deal.
That is a huge deal.
Right?
To this day, I still think that's a very big deal.
And you can get it immediately
on Reddit. No,
yeah.
But you're right though. You're right. Other things that happened, again, that contribute to what we have to this day, throughout the late 90s, Google, 1998, came about, quickly superseded Yahoo as the number one search engine.
So Google was like a lightning bolt.
Yeah.
What was so fascinating about Google is a lot of the search engines work, but sometimes they give you weird results and they were off a little bit.
Like Hotbot and Lycos and all that shit.
It just wasn't, or Ask Jeeves or whatever.
Fuck Ask Jeeves, by the way.
By the way, I always liked the concept of Ask Jeeves, that it's an ask based search engine.
Yeah, I understand.
Right?
But he didn't know half. He didn't know shit.
Yeah, but it was a good idea.
Dummy.
And even Google kind of turned into that because Google, some people would just start typing questions in Google on their own. But Google was so smart and ahead of the curve that it could take that. It could parse that, right?
It did. And yeah, it did.
Like, Google was unbelievable when it came out. You can't, it's really hard to explain unless you were there. It just kind of like, you would use it and it was just light years ahead of the other ones. Like, and that's why it became, and it was fast. It didn't take any time to load anything.
I heard about it in seventh grade and I started using it. It became my search engine immediately.
And it was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Suddenly the internet was like, everything was available to you.
They're a touchstone in all of this. They really are. You touched on it briefly, Quinn, the DSL line. Higher speed internet began to not only become available, but began to be in demand from consumers by the late 90s.
Yes, and one of the demands for this, and I think now is a good time to talk about it, was Napster.
Yeah.
So Napster is another one of our early legal internet battles.
Yep, and right? we did a full episode of Velvet Archives.
But the point is that one of the applications that quickly became a thing was Napster, and if you're not old enough to know what Napster was a way to get music for free.
Illegally, probably
on the internet through peer-to-peer connection. And it was specifically peer. It didn't come from a server, so that's how it could like avoid tracking and any
other
of that.
People just had the files.
Right. So you would type in this song and it would show a ton of users who were who had their share button on that also had the song and you could download from them, right? Okay. The whole thing with a song is they were roughly 3 to 4 megabytes. Now, you might laugh at that nowadays.
Ha!
But for a 56K modem, this could take an hour or two.
It really could.
And I feel from that point on, that is the application that opened people's eyes to the value of a faster internet.
I think you're right. You know the Big Mac Index, you know, to measure and pricing things. I think that Napster, or at least downloading MP3, that was kind of the measuring stick for the speed of your internet connection.
Right.
When we first, my stepfather had it on his computer, cable, Comcast, in 2000.
I didn't give a shit about internet speed until Napster.
Exactly. And when I saw how quickly he could download a song, I was like, holy shit.
Yeah, it's like, I need this. Right. It was like such a time saver.
Yeah.
This is Telocity, high velocity DSL internet service.
And so this was you're right. It was the measuring stick. It was how fast could it download that file size.
Yeah.
And they would advertise it in seconds. And they sometimes they would advertise their speeds as like, well, if you get this one, it will take a minute. If you get this one, it'll take 30 seconds. Like that kind of thing, right? And this was an important thing. Just the advance to broadband alone, just basic
broadband,
1 megabit per second, right? Which was like, whoa, 1 megabit per second. But why was that important? Because that meant you could download a song in roughly 30 seconds or something
that. It was huge.
It was massive.
And there were all different, you know, like DSL lines. Verizon started offering DSL. Mm-hmm. There was ISDN, but not a lot of consumers.
For
that
a
was
long
more like
time, broadband
use.
Was basically anything faster than 56K.
Yeah.
But it was a generic term for basically anything faster than 56K.
Exactly. Cable became, I think, at least in my area, cable became the most predominant one. Mm-hmm. People just switched to cable because, again, the idea, well, you already have the cable company.
You don't have to hook it. They just send you a thing that hooks in your existing coaxial, right?
We talked about this in our history of cable episode.
But as far as the internet as a cultural thing, this opened the door.
It
right?
did.
This opened the door for conventional media, right? Once we got past the song threshold, very quickly the video threshold came in.
That's
right?
the thing, because people had always, I want to watch video on the internet. Who didn't want to do that, right?
Right.
You can't do that with it. You know how long it took to download a shitty, like, real video file?
But it wasn't even just that, too. There was also the problem of the fact that the processors on computers and stuff were not really built to play, decode,
as
it was called. Like, they were really not built for this. And again, I feel that Napster is what kind of encouraged, because suddenly there started to be processes built into the, you know, the Pentiums of the world. And then once we got to the Core processors and the AMD and all that, that was like, okay, we built a decoder into the processor so it can, you know, decode a video file real fast. And then now you just need the file, right? Now we need the speed to get the file.
That's a great point.
Right?
We're in a situation here at the turn of the 21st century, really, the early part of it, where the consumer demand is like they want more, more, and more. The software end of things is like, well, we want to give you more, more, and more. And the hardware is like, well, we need to. So everyone, it's like
everyone needed to keep jump. They didn't even need, they were in different sectors, but they needed to keep up so that each one of the pillars could keep moving. Right?
Exactly. It was like a relay race almost.
Right.
It was
like, okay, now we need the hardware. Okay, the hardware's up. Now we need the. And it was just on and on and on and on.
And then the consumer would be like, well, what about this? Right. What about that? We want this. And that led also to, in the mid-2000s, around 2004-05, to Web 2.0. Now, Web 2.0, Quinn, is kind of a vague term, but I mean, there are things about it. It's an umbrella term for basically the way the internet changed from like the standard HTML days of the 90s to more of like the YouTube, Facebook, more interactive, more instantaneous.
More social.
Yeah, two-way communication.
Right. So it's kind of like a weird term I've always felt. Yeah. And I feel like it gets mixed with Web 2 and Web 3. To me, what it represents is the jump from individual websites with a bunch of crap on them, like, then you just didn't know, like, the what it's the difference between the Wild West internet and the civilized internet.
There you go.
You know what I mean? Like, it, sure. that's what it is.
That's a great way to look at it.
Mega corporations getting involved in the pages being slicker. I don't know any other way to put them. Like, they were just, they looked professional.
They looked more professional. The designs were streamlined.
Yeah.
Now, this is a point, you know, we're talking about 20 years ago. Every company's got a website by this point. Like, this is, thing anymore.
But the problem is there's no uniformity to it. And there's no, and what I mean by that, I don't mean that every website needs to look the same, but it has to have a common language that people understand, like, okay, the menu bars on the left side.
You mean like an interface?
Like an interface, UI-wise, like a common user interface that people, you know, every web page they go to, there are little things that they might look a little different, but they're kind of familiar.
There's a magnifying glass somewhere on the top right, perhaps, right?
Like, and you can just, you know what you're doing on every web page, right? And there's also, with all of this too, we were talking about the media apps, but there was a growing period where it had to move from illegitimate to legitimate.
Yeah.
And this is where you get iTunes.
Yeah, iTunes.
iTunes is the first one. And what
later
iTunes,
Spotify.
So what iTunes did and why it's important here is because a lot of the fallout from Napster, right? It was the music industry got reamed from this. Because this, again, if you didn't live through it, you don't understand. But it got so out of control so quickly that everyone and their mother knew that, why would I buy a CD?
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah.
But it's all free and I have a CD burner and I can do all this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I can just get as all the music I want.
I think you are right. Even my mom knew because my stepfather downloaded
fast
music.
It was like within a year.
Yeah, it was quick.
It blew the hell up. Like every single person, a lot of people bought computers for this.
Yeah, it was a big deal.
Because music was popular.
Or they got high-speed internet for it, like we talked about.
Everyone bought all this equipment and all this shit because they knew it was going to pay off because they would never have to buy music again.
And then as we mentioned, it was all gone.
Right, suddenly it was ripped and it was this piecemeal. There was Morpheus and LimeWire. And it just got, well, okay, what the fuck,
that
right?
That sucked, by the way, but as we mentioned.
In the wake of this, Apple saw an opportunity.
Yes.
And they said, we can release a thing, A, that plays the music and you can take it. Because that was one thing that didn't, you had to sit at a computer or hook it to your stereo or whatever. So we can release this thing called the iPod. It's kind of like a Walkman. We talked about all this shit, right? But the bigger thing, the application as far as the internet's concerned is iTunes.
Yeah.
And what iTunes did that was so smart is they did fight the record companies on this because the record companies immediately were like, well, we want it to be $5 or $10 a song.
Yeah, it was horrible.
And Apple just said, nobody's gonna buy this. Like nobody's gonna fucking buy this. It's over. The cat's out of the bag. Everyone figured out how to get it for free. We need to onboard them back to paying for music, not charge them $5 or $10 a song.
Well, Apple was completely right in this case.
And they said 99 cents a song, every song.
Yeah.
And this worked. Believe it or not, it was rough at the beginning, but it worked.
It absolutely worked, yeah. again, it gave way to other ones such as Spotify, and right. there were others.
I think what it did the hard work of was getting people, the market, back to expecting to pay for music in some shape or form again.
It was that one. Yep.
It needed to happen for there to be a music industry.
And it also familiarized people with the idea of downloading your songs,
right.
putting them onto a device, and listening to them
wherever
you wanted.
It might not have been a long-term solution, but I think it was necessary to get people to understand
where we were headed.
Right. Like it was a necessary step.
In much the same way, YouTube, which came about in 2005, that created the expectation of I want to watch everything on my computer.
Right. But it was all free.
It was all free at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as we talked about in the decline of the Blockbuster episode back when, that eventually gave way to Netflix.
Subscription services.
Hulu, all of them.
Which also had been applied to the music industry.
Correct.
So basically, like, through all of this, like, Web 2.0 and the internet started to become a primary vehicle for media.
Not just communication.
So, and those were, like, the most popular applications, I feel like. Music and movies, right?
I think so.
And video games, to a certain extent. Anything that could be digitally distributed. And we're not even talking about the commerce yet.
Well, that's the other end of it, right?
Right.
So we had mentioned eBay, which was strictly a used auction site at the time of its founding. And as the years went on, it began to be synonymous with another big one, Amazon, which started as a book retailer, wholesaler.
Yes. So Amazon, when it came about, it was kind of a revelation.
Yes.
Because what Amazon did initially, even with just the books, I feel like it really streamlined the process. It was very complicated in the early days of, can I give my credit card to these people?
Well, I know. That was always
a concern.
Like,
how does this work?
Yeah.
Can I trust them?
Right.
It's not scary, and it's very, very fast.
Amazon.com discounts so many books that even with the shipping, you end up saving money.
And Amazon, I feel, presented itself as a trustworthy website.
Yeah.
That you felt comfortable. It's like, okay, I can enter my credit card in here, and when I buy something from it, they send something. And it was a lot of word of mouth, too. It was like, everyone was like, no, Amazon, they're okay. Like, they're not going to... Because that was a big thing. Again, it was the Wild West. Is it okay? And PayPal came out of eBay also as a means to... Well, PayPal, the service was... The idea was like... You give us your credit card, and we're like a bank, essentially.
Yeah.
And like,
we'll watch it for you.
We'll you just give them your PayPal ID, and we'll handle the security. What PayPal did that was important was, is if somebody ripped you off, PayPal guaranteed that they give you your money
back. That's the thing, yeah.
Right.
It's like giving your keys to the valet almost. You know, I'll take care of your car. Don't worry about it. But it's
true,
though.
More like the bank. I feel like they were the bank.
I was just being funny.
Yeah.
Amazon was huge. I mean, I use Amazon... God, more times per week than I care to admit.
But that development happened over time.
It did. It wasn't right away.
It wasn't right away. Amazon started selling other stuff, and then a little more, and then a little more, and then a little more, and then it just was everything.
Then they're buying Whole Foods, right?
Yeah.
Then they're streaming music and movies.
Right.
It became like Amazon was like the Walmart of the internet.
But what was the breakthrough for Amazon, I feel personally, and it's the one thing that still keeps them ahead of the game.
Yes,
right?
Sir.
Free shipping.
It was huge. Amazon Prime.
And this, to me, Amazon Prime is such a huge development in the internet as a whole. It sounds stupid.
For better or for worse,
by
the way.
For better or for worse, because one of the things that I feel like held the internet back from people purchasing on it was that shipping was just so expensive.
Well, yeah.
And so Amazon said, you sign up for a subscription with us, don't worry about the shipping. We got the shipping.
Yeah.
Suddenly... people just started buying everything because it was so cheap. It was like, what was it? I feel like it was like $60 a year or something.
Initially, Prime membership, it was cheap.
It was cheap.
Yeah,
and it was like, hey, by the way, you get a streaming service and a music and all this shit too. Like, and it was just suddenly Amazon became the everything store.
It really did.
Because it was so smart. It was such a smart idea to guarantee shipping because shipping was what held the internet back as far as e-commerce was concerned.
I think you're right. And along all these same lines, too, other things began to crop up in the last 15 years. You know, you could always go to like dominoes.com and order and track your order. But once high-speed internet became available to a smartphone, which we talked about in our cell phone episode.
Yes. Available in the archives.
This gave way to not only, you know, the commerce that we talked about in the music and the video, but...
Ordering food
from your phone. Now you don't have
to
talk to anyone.
Or groceries even. You can even order from the grocery store. If you want individual stuff.
I believe GoPuff is one of those things, right? We used that recently when our friend Richard was here.
Early days, what was it? Pack?
I don't know, probably.
P-Pack. That was the first
P-Pack?
One. It was the P-Pack? It was a service that would go to the grocery store and take your shopping list and then deliver.
Really?
Yeah.
P-Pack?
A&P owned it or something.
Not Peapod, P-Pack?
Peapod? I don't.
P-Pack's a bank.
I don't remember which one.
It doesn't really matter.
Oh, hi. I have to correct the yeah. So it was called Peapod, and it actually was owned by Stop and Shop.
I think what comes down to all of this stuff, right?
Yes.
The media, products, food, that kind of thing, is that it really turned the digital, not tangible aspect of the internet into real things that people could hold in their hand, that they could punch one thing in the digital and it would come out as a product on the physical. And like that is what made the internet transcendent. It like suddenly became necessary.
I think you're right. You know, the internet, there's a lot of arguments to be made and they'd be correct about maybe some of the negative aspects of it in terms of the way people can now get harassed through the internet. A lot of different things, right?
Or they won't leave their house because everything can just be brought to
them. And those are all valid concerns. But at the same time, the level of communication that it's brought, the level of
convenience
that it's brought, I don't think there's ever going to be any going back from that.
So it's two things, right? Here's maybe the utopian look at it is that...
Well, you are Mr. Quinfest.
Right. Quinstock. The concept is like... I think even when it was being developed, because this is the other thing about it, is it came from a place of those bright-eyed, bushy-tailed tech guys of the 70s and 80s.
Yes, and Strom Thurmond.
Real nerds that had this vision of like, you know, we're building all of this to have like this utopian society where everything's simple and everything's at the touch of a button. And, you know, we'll have time to do other things like hang out with our families or like go on vacation or whatever. We won't have to do all this crap.
I'm sure even Lick himself thought this in the 50s, right?
Yeah, all these people, you know, the Woz and Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, even like all these tech entrepreneurs. A lot of it came out of this weird, like, hippy dippy. These guys went to school in the 60s and learned at MIT in the 70s, and like
it's
all this
like total communication, man.
Yeah, it's going to be total communication, and we won't, you know, we won't be confused anymore, right? And everything's just going to be great. And a lot of it was built on those weird like
ideals
and thought processes and stuff. And obviously, it got more twisted, as the years went on. But at the end of the day, I feel like the crux of it is it's like a super useful tool, and it does make your life easier.
Oh, I think so. Listen, I have gone through periods where I'm like, all right, I'm staring at my phone too fucking much. And that's often, but at the same time, you know, there's a lot of good that you can do with this communication that we have these days. And
and that's the other thing is it's so interesting, right? Because one of the aspects of the internet is that you need some kind of electronic device to use it. And what you can do on these electronic devices, phones or PCs even, you can do work. You can make things. Like you can be a software developer or something.
Yeah, or an engineer.
And this openness of the internet too, where it's completely open.
Yeah.
Right? If you can distribute stuff and you could start your own business, right? There's a lot of pluses here that people tend to forget because they think of the social stuff.
Well, that's true. I guess one thing that we didn't really touch upon, although it is a given, is what this did just for office jobs. Now, there's no replacing, eventually maybe with robots, but there's no replacing a lot of manual labor jobs. And those I respect the hell out of that.
No, and it's not to replace that. You still need people to farm the land.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You can't just completely get rid of it.
But the idea, you know, when office computers started cropping up, especially in the 80s and into the 90s, that you could now send an email instead of a regular letter or a fax, or that you could now...
It's good for the environment. You're not wasting paper.
Well, that's the other thing, too. There was a lot of conveniences, and I think we all understand that here. One great thing about the internet, too, is that we're able to do this show, and people are able to hear it. I mean, it is.
You know, that's another aspect from an entertainment perspective that I thought was one of my favorite things and quickly became something, and probably why I wanted to do a podcast in the first place. I loved, especially in the early internet, before it got taken over by influencers who were, you look into them and you come to find out that they're backed by some, they're like some Nepo baby or something. Yeah, and like, that's why they're popular.
Generally, not like, always, but yeah.
But and maybe there's people who are too young, but like in the early days, it was so inspirational. I know it sounds stupid, but like the Angry Video Game Nerd, for example.
Sure. He influenced a lot of people.
Or the early days of podcast. It was the concept that somebody who had a unique opinion could get that opinion out, you know, have their own show or do this. And it wasn't filtered by corporations or government or anything. Yeah. It was just unfiltered, like, this is what I think of this, or and you can agree with me or disagree with me, and hey, let's make it entertaining and make it showbiz or whatever. Like, and I miss that about the early internet, and that a lot of that was like the early 2000s.
Yeah, that's about right.
It was like a special time. There was just so much of it, right? And it was so interesting, and you would find out all sorts of interesting stuff.
You know, it's an interesting point, though, for whether you're like, even from a musician standpoint or any type of content creator, 30 years ago, even 25 years ago, even maybe even 20.
Yeah, you could hear music right back then that like it doesn't go through the record company. It's just some guy.
And the old school way of doing that was the old DIY attitude of having to distribute things yourself. The internet
sells cassettes out of the back of your car.
Now you have the internet as your conduit, because the dream always used to be, oh, I want to be on TV, I want to be on the radio, from our generation and before. Once this came about where, you know, you just upload a YouTube video of whatever the fuck, or, you know, do this.
Or you can put it on Instagram now.
Or put it on Instagram or TikTok or anything, or even dump in a stupid AI voice for humor.
The answer is this 21st century podcast speaks of retro pop culture nostalgia, but it won't make you clean. Hulk.
What is ass washing memories?
No, Dave.
Because a podcast is because I used to, well, I still sometimes, I have cool headphones, and I, oh, darn.
Jim?
How about kiss my ass?
No, sorry. Not enough chapstick. The correct answer is acid-washed memories.
You know, that really has superseded the, I want to be on TV, I want to be on the radio.
The gatekeepers. Like,
yeah.
The record companies and Paramount Pictures and, you know, whoever, the motion picture studios.
What are you making fun of Paramount?
I'm just in general, like, the entertainment gatekeepers, the big companies. Like,
yeah, you know, I mean, they're still there if you want to make money.
Right.
But now as far as distributing, no, anyone can go on YouTube. You have the same access.
And they can get the same views.
Exactly, you can.
It's possible. And that is a huge deal if you grew up before that. I don't want to sound like bitter and resentful.
Oh, here we go. Ready for Quinn to sound bitter and resentful?
But I do resent a little bit of the generation that was born after the existence of this.
Why? What did they do wrong?
It's only because of how they use it.
As what do you mean?
Meaning that it's thought of, it's taken for granted.
Well,
I find the people that came before it that are doing this, they're a little more, like you, for example. But this is more of a general sentiment of people that came before the ease of use of it.
You're
is that you have a million all this equipment and you have an attention to detail for quality, but that really comes more from an older thought process of it, that it's got to be like that.
Are you calling me old?
I'm not calling
you old.
I'm
only 9 months older than you, pal.
I'm saying that is a cultural, a social thing where when the tools were easily given. I always give the analogy of like people born before cars and people born after, like many years after cars. When cars came about, people knew how to fix them. You know what I mean? And they didn't take them for granted. They were very interested in them. But once they became a utility... You know, I don't even know how it fucking works.
I was just going to say, are you saying you don't know how to change a tire?
I do.
Okay, just double checking.
All I'm getting at is it's the same thing applies with the internet and technology.
There's
an attention to detail. I mean, we know how to build our own computers and all this shit because we had to.
But at the same time, it's, you know, having something that can be taken for granted is not inherently a bad thing. I mean,
it's not.
We take electricity for granted, Quinn.
Of course,
you know.
But I'm just making the point that
I don't fault the generation. They didn't ask to be born at this time.
I'm just making the point that I do think that if you grew up while this was emerging,
which
you have
did.
A very different attitude towards it maybe. Than it, if you grew up after it had already emerged.
Listen, I truthfully don't know if we have anyone younger than 30 listening to us.
Probably not.
But if you are out there and you are younger than 30 or perhaps teetering on the edge of, you know, millennial and Gen Z, please send all of your tweets directly to SilentQ15 on Twitter. Yeah. No, but in all seriousness, I do understand where you're coming from. I guess to button it all up here, though, Quinn, in the 38 years I've been alive, the 33 or so that I remember things, you know, mm-hmm. since I was about 5 years old, this was a big one. This was really a big one growing up. This
it's
is a big change.
Probably one of, if not the biggest technology advances in our lifetimes, even bigger than the phones.
I think so.
Because it's the foundation for all of this stuff. Like it's the killer app. It's the thing,
it
right?
Really
it's
is.
Like it's the point of all of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, however you use the internet, folks, as long as it's for good, I don't really see a problem with it. You know what I mean? I try to raise my I have a 6 year old. Try to raise him to just you know meter your time in front of a screen. You know, mm-hmm. he still goes outside, he still plays, he still talks to people in real life. You know,
right.
And there seems to be a stigma that it prevents people from doing that entirely, which I don't think is true. I still see kids playing all
it
the
doesn't.
Time because they make noise.
Yeah,
you know, in the yards.
But it has its social impacts, is what it
certainly.
And I would say, in a weird, stupid way that shows how important it actually is that it actually transcended just a thing that like a convenience or something.
I think so.
It's not like because of 7-Eleven that people's change
well, yeah,
everything
lives
about
are
their
all
life.
Changed, right?
Yeah.
No, but it allows people to work a job in another state. It allows distant family members to talk to each other whenever they want. It allows you to watch things that you wouldn't be able to get on television or rent movies or buy music.
It allows for art, like different motion pictures and music, to be made.
And it allows for artists to distribute their work.
Yeah.
I think it's a great thing overall. Obviously, like anything else, including a bottle of bleach or a lawnmower, there are hazards when used improperly.
Yeah.
But bottom line, it is, I think, enriched a lot of people's lives. It has connected people that wouldn't otherwise know each other. And most importantly, it's allowed us to do this show.
Yes.
So, folks, we hope you enjoyed this little history sprinkling of the internet here. We really do appreciate you. Next week will be something completely different, as it always is. Until that time, enjoy your time on SciClide Network. Let us know what you think of Tim Berners-Lee. Send your hate tweets to Quinn, as I mentioned, and follow us at AWM Podcast on Twitter. Join our Facebook group, and please leave us a review. But until next time, this is Joe Marotta. That is Michael Quinn, and we are logging off.
See ya.
Like what you heard? Be sure to leave a review and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. We will see you next week.